What exactly happened this summer? ?2020 has been one of the most unexpected and unprecedented years in the United States. Since the death of George Floyd in May, the United States has seen some civil unrest, some protests, and even some that have devolved into riots and violence, in addition to the devastation and loss of life from COVID-19. We've also seen the rise of the Black Lives Matter movement, which has sought racial equality and the defeat of social injustice through demonstrations and protests. On this, the first episode of Season 2 of Tartan Talks, we've hosted a live session with Professors Dr. Rhonda Matthews and Professor Julie Berry to discuss this summer. What happened? What were the implications of what happened? And what can we expect to happen in the future? This is the first in a series of diversity dialogues that we will be having on campus, so we thought it might be a good idea to reach our audience on here on Tartan Talks so we can share this information from these experts with you personally. Stay tuned for more from Tartan Talks. This is the first episode of Season 2. Thanks for joining us. My name is Christopher LaFuria, host of Tartan Talks. This is Tartan Talks, a podcast from Edinburgh University. I'm your host, Christopher LaFuria. Each month, we'll take a look at individuals who make Edinburgh an exciting, diverse, and profound place to discover your passions. All right, everybody. Good evening. My name is Christopher LaFuria with Edinburgh University, and I'm here with two Edinburgh faculty members who are going to be addressing some of the issues that we saw throughout the United States this summer. We have here today Dr. Rhonda Matthews. She's an associate professor of politics at Edinburgh, who specializes in women's issues, gender and race issues, and stratification. She's also one of our experts on pop culture, especially its intersection with race. Julie Berry is an assistant professor in social work. A lot of her work deals with racial trauma and women's issues. So we brought together two faculty members and experts on these topics from different areas of campus, different academic concentrations, who are both going to talk about similar topics. And we are going to be talking about what has happened this summer, whether it's racial issues, COVID-19. There's so many things that happened this summer. We're going to try and fit it all in this hour. And we wanted to welcome everybody who's joining us on our YouTube channel and everybody from our Tartan Talks podcast. Thank you for joining us today. So just a little bit of background. We're going to be talking about specifically the last 3 months where we saw thousands of protests, some peaceful, some have devolved into violence that has swept the United States regarding the deaths of George Floyd and the recent shooting involving Jacob Blake, who we're still waiting to hear on his status right now. We're also going to be talking about how COVID-19 has impacted race relations and how it has affected minority groups a lot more. Just from the CDC website, it says that longstanding systemic health and social inequities have increased the risk of minority groups for getting COVID-19 and dying from the virus. Also, if you look at a Pew Research study from 2019, it says the majority of Americans, about 7 out of 10, say that race relations are getting worse in the United States, with about 58% saying that race relations in the United States are generally bad. Without further ado, I want to welcome Dr. Matthews and Professor Berry here to Tartan Talks, to Edinburgh University's Dialogue on Diversity. You're going to learn a lot in this hour. If you do have comments or follow-up questions about something that we've talked today, you can send them to the YouTube comments, or you can send them to communications@edinburgh.edu, and we will try and get you answers as much as possible. Well, here we are. Thank you for joining us today. I give you Dr. Rhonda Matthews and Professor Julie Berry.
Thank you, Chris. Thank you. And thank you to Dr. Terrence Mitchell, who asked us to be a part of this discussion tonight. I want to talk a little bit first about the ground rules. Oh, sorry, and welcome. Thank you for being here. We can't see you, but we know you can see us, and so we're good. So I want to introduce what we're going to talk about tonight and how we're going to do this. So we are going to have a discussion. We are, you know, we are knowledgeable in our own subject areas, and you'll hear, we'll talk about some of that. But we also don't want to lecture, and we don't want to present. We just want to have a discussion. And we want to have an informed discussion. And one of the reasons for that is because there are a lot of people talking, not necessarily knowledgeably. So we want to be a part of the kinds of discussions that we just have kind of on a regular basis. There are a couple things I want you to pay attention to. One is that we are going to be discussing mature themes. So if you have small children in the room, you might want to, put on an episode of Steven Universe or Avatar Last Airbender or something else. It's probably not good for them to engage with some of the things that we're going to talk about tonight. The other thing is that it is an informal discussion for us. One of the things that happens, you know, when people discuss is that, you know, their language is relaxed. And so one of the things that's going to happen is you're going to see a switch between academic speak and Black woman speak. Mm-hmm. We're going to be code switching throughout our discussion. So don't let that throw you. So let me tell you why we wanted to do it this way. So when we talk about social upheaval and change, I think a lot about what women do. Most people think about what men do, because when we see social change, right, there are always men at the forefront of it. But what we know is that women are generally the people doing the planning and the legwork, et cetera. One of the ways that women make change is through talking, or just through discussion, through planning, through trying to figure it out. And so we wanted to model some of that behavior here. A lot of people talk about, you know, well, women talk too much. Well, first of all, we don't talk nearly as much as men do, because we're often not in the positions to do that. But when we do talk, we talk with one another, and we talk about things, and we talk things out. And so that's what we want to do here today. So our theme is, what did we learn this summer? What did you learn?
Not a thing. I don't think that as a Black woman, mother, spouse, I didn't really learn much of anything. It was all stuff that I already knew, that we live in a racist society, and there are a lot of racial disparities that our society wants to put a, you know, eye mask over, pretend like they don't see it. But I think with things such as the police brutality, the death of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor, and COVID-19, we saw firsthand that Black people were extremely affected by all of this.
Right. You know, one of the things, I think you're right, like I felt like all of the things that we were seeing and all of the responses that we were seeing, I was, you know, almost every day I was like, we been knew that.
Right.
But one of the things I did learn, though, and I think this is unique to this summer, is that lots of white people really did have their eyes opened.
Right.
I think I have to be careful about how I say it. I'm not glad about that. Like, I'm like gleeful, because this stuff is painful, right? And it's been painful to, you know, Black and Brown and LGBTQ folks, trans people for, you know, hundreds of years. But, excuse me, so I'm not gleeful about people discovering this awfulness. I'm not, but I also feel like, you know, this is stuff that you know, we already knew as Black women. But I have to say that one of the things I discovered is that I'm glad that people who did not know about this stuff beforehand are beginning to go through the process of learning and, you know, listening and trying to figure it out, because they recognize that this is bad.
Right.
Can you imagine if we didn't have technology? I mean,
right. Right.
We wouldn't be talking about any of this
right.
if people weren't walking around with computers in their hands.
Right.
Right.
That also leads, I think, to a lot of the constant re-traumatization of watching these things over and over in real time. Mm-hmm. And even what was yesterday or the day before, Jacob Blake getting shot point blank range.
Right.
You know, for everyone to see. Again, we say that this is for mature audiences, but children also have access to this. And then people are just like, you get sort of, I don't want to say, well, I guess desensitized mm-hmm. to this kind of violence constantly mm-hmm. to Black people.
I agree. So let's back up and talk about what kind of kicked off what. The thing that struck a match to this summer was the killing on camera of George Floyd. So I avoided that. I knew, you know, I had heard, I have narrowed my intake of visual media
right.
so that I can, as much as possible, guard myself against seeing those kinds of images over and over over again. So I read about it before I ever saw the video. And then, you know, I was, you know, just like you are on social media, you know, you're almost always accidentally introduced to some video that you didn't mean to see because somebody put it on their feed and you're scrolling past it. Oh, there it is. So I saw, you know, a few, I saw maybe about 30 seconds, maybe 45 seconds of it before I just could not watch the entire thing. So I agree with you. I think that what happened with George Floyd, what happened to George Floyd was just the tipping point for a lot of people because we've been watching these videos.
Right. In real life in our neighborhoods
right.
every day for
right.
forever.
Right. And so, but the difference is that other people
right.
saw it too.
Right.
Right. Other people saw it. And the casual violence with which he snuffed out that man's life.
Right.
I mean, it's just, how can anybody be that cruel?
Right.
How can, you know, and so look, you know, I remember you talking about, you know, people just keep continually watching it. And like some people are continually watching it because they just can't believe it.
Right.
How can anybody behave in this way?
Right. And I think, and I remember I was talking to someone who was white and they were trying to make sense of it. They wanted me to make sense of it for them. And, you know, and I felt like this summer it put Black people in a position of trying to teach white people how to treat us. Like they wanted some kind of guidebook on, you know, well, okay, now that this happened, how should I proceed?
What can I do to help?
Right. Mm-hmm. And you know, this person said to me, well, you know, I just want to know your lived experiences. And I said, well, you need to go on any type of social media, turn on the news, 8 minutes and 46 seconds of a video, you can watch the police snuff out a Black man. That could be my father, my brother, my son, you know, anybody. And I think for most Black people, as they watch that, that's what they thought, like, or even that could be me,
right.
You know, that could be me. I could be going to the grocery store and get, you know,
Right. Monday, every day, Monday.
Right.
So when I think about it, what I think about is the fact that this is a standard practice in our culture that a whole lot of people never witnessed or experienced for themselves, right? So this is a cultural feature. This is a widespread social interaction. Like, I think what happened with George Floyd for people was that they recognized these are not isolated incidents, right? People who didn't experience it every day, right? Who didn't fear for their brothers or their friends, you know, going to the convenience store to get,
right,
you know, Skittles and tea, right? So I think that, so when I think about it, among other things, the pattern I think about the most is that this was a widespread cultural practice that a whole lot of people didn't know about, but now understand it to be a widespread cultural practice, right? I mean, it's like, you know, people kind of get upset when you use the word lynching, when you talk about it, but there is really no difference in the images that we saw, you know, in the, you know, 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, and that. The only difference is that there's not even a difference in terms of the fact that it was documented, right?
Right.
There's lots of pictures, you know, people standing
right
around, you know, a man's body and smiling and bringing picnic lunches, right? So we don't have that component of it anymore, like the happy people, you know, let's make it a celebration. But it's the same behavior, right? It's what's happening is they're lynchings. The difference is that now more people understand it for what it is. And I think that that is one of the things that triggered this summer, right? That set it off. And so people were like, oh, hell no, right? We cannot. If we claim to be decent people, we can't continue to let this happen. I didn't know about it yesterday, but I know about it today. And that actually, I think, is that's a positive thing. And it's actually also the first step in widespread social change, right? The dissemination of knowledge. People know.
Right. I also think that, like, when we talk about lynching, I think about how those people who were lynched were seen as criminals,
mm-hmm,
or deviants, you know, and the same thing is being done,
mm-hmm,
to these victims,
mm-hmm,
of police brutality, like being murdered by police officers. You know, they'll say George Floyd was trying to, you know, use a counterfeit $20 bill, or you know, one guy was selling illegal, you know, videos outside of a grocery store, or like it's always, you know, even I don't know, you murdered him.
was selling loose cigarettes
worth
the death penalty.
Right,
right. But here's one of the things that I've been seeing, though. I've been seeing those attempts to do that. And what's different about this time is that people are rejecting that. You know, widespread, people
right
are rejecting it. That is why people are out in the streets, right? Because while people, when people give that, when there's that reason, well, he was doing X, Y, or Z, then I think what used to happen in our culture is that people would say, oh, okay, well, I didn't know he was doing bad things. And so, and now people are like, and what does that have to do with anything?
Right.
You know, and they're saying it angrily. And I think that's justified and is warranted. And it's a shift away from, we're just gonna accept that you're out here killing people,
right,
and we're not gonna allow that to happen without making some comment on it. And that is a cultural shift. I'm glad to see it, but boy, when I tell you, you know, this is, it's painful now, and it's going to be painful for a while. I mean, this stuff doesn't change overnight.
No, not at all.
We have to keep working at it.
No.
Yeah, yeah. And then when we think about even the differences, so we have had that cultural shift, but we still have not addressed the killings of people who are not men.
Right, Breonna Taylor.
Right.
They won't even say the police officers. I mean, we know their names, but it's so, you know, we don't ever address that.
Mm-hmm. Well, here in Erie.
Right.
You know, when the law enforcement person kicked a woman who was sitting on the ground who had been, you know, pepper sprayed, tear gas, which I don't remember which one it was, right? So, but we don't, you know, that we haven't heard anything else about that, right? Trans women, especially Black trans women, you know, are being murdered at astronomical rates. And those are not things that we hear about on the quote-unquote mainstream news outlets. So we still have a long way to go. We really do. But this shift, I think, is important. I think this is an important moment in our cultural history and hopefully practice.
Yeah.
Okay, so what else are we going to talk about?
I guess we could talk about George Floyd kicked off all the protests and
Black Lives Matter. Black Lives Matter is the creation of the movement and the organization that now support it, I think are really, really important and really necessary.
Right.
But I gotta tell you, what interests me most is the backlash against it.
Right,
right.
we were riding down the street the other day and we saw an All Lives Matter sign of someone's.
Right.
Well, they had an All Lives Matter and a Blue Lives Matter in their yard. And, you know, me and the kids all did a, you know, back turn.
Mm-hmm.
But the only way I can describe like Black Lives Matter, like people just think that like it's just some sort of takeover. Like, you know, no, we're just pointing out that there are some racial and, you know, injustices and disparities that need to be taken care of, you know, so that really all lives will matter once Black lives matter.
Right,
you
right.
Know?
I think it's a significant indictment of our culture that when people are pointing out that there are ingrained injustices,
mm-hmm,
against, you know, through our power structure,
mm-hmm,
against one or more groups of people, you know, in these,
right,
the fact that people take it as some sort of slight or, like you said, as a threat or a challenge is just astounding to me. I mean, on the one hand, it's astounding. On the other hand, you know, when you study history or when you study, you know, sociological interaction, I mean, in this nation especially, it kind of makes sense. But when people are in diametrical opposition to it, it just highlights, I think, even more what the organization and the movement is saying,
right.
And what they're trying to address. I mean, think about what that means,
right?
That you don't want to acknowledge that that there's a group of people out here who are fighting against the injustice that is being hurled against this one group of people. So
the systematic, you know, racism that runs through all aspects of their lives.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's not just one, you know, they're not just, you know, one injustice, but like all aspects.
Right.
you know, right, our lives.
Which is why I like the title of the movement and the organization so much.
Right.
Because the word in the middle, lives,
right,
is the most important,
right,
word, right? Because we, you know, in our founding documents, right, in our sacred documents, it states, you know, that we are supposed to have access to the pursuit of life, liberty, and happiness. Life is the first thing in there, right? So part of what I wonder about, I mean, I don't really wonder about it, but sometimes I really want to say to people, you know, when they have that response, what about the life part that's in our founding ideals? Now, I mean, we all know that stuff was not written for the vast majority of people. I mean, we know that, but it's here. It's written now. You can't take it. You can't take it back. You wrote it down. You can't take it back. And I'm here now, so we're going to access that, right? But to rail against, you know, a group of people. In this instance, we're talking about Black folks trying to access life,
right,
in the way that it's meant to be life. You know, unencumbered. You know, with you know, freedom and liberty and all the things that go along with that. To deny that Black Lives Matter by saying all lives matter is a fundamental rejection,
right,
of those founding ideals. And I don't think that people think about that a whole lot when they're saying, well, you know, all lives matter. And no one is saying that they don't.
Right.
But what you said, I think, is the most succinct way to say it. You know, once Black lives matter, all lives will matter. Once Indigenous, and we can go
right
through the line, yep, then all lives will matter.
Right.
Yeah. I'd like to see us get to that point, but I think we have to go through this fire first.
Mm-hmm.
I do. I really think we do. I think we have to get to a point where people recognize all along the way that we can't keep doing this to groups of people. We can't keep systematically discriminating against people, because if we think that this summer was something, it can get much worse, right? When people feel like there's no hope, or they have nowhere to turn in the institutions that are supposed to support them, then, you know, they take matters into their own hands. And we have a system that should allow for us,
right,
to participate.
Right. Yeah. And I was gonna say, and I think jump around a little bit, but COVID-19 kind of like just put a magnifying glass on us. You know, you already are sitting at home in isolation without access to things. I think I read a statistic that Black people make up about 14% of the population, and they work like 17 to 20% of the essential worker jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, our society or government or whoever try to glamorize these people working out, these essential workers. Oh, you're, you know, keeping America going, and they were dying. Like these
grocery store workers.
Yeah, they were dying. And
Walmart.
They were bringing COVID-19 home, and families were dying. You know, and they don't have access. These same workers who work at the grocery store don't have healthcare access.
Mm-hmm.
You know. So again, it just shows like the breakdown in our system of all the things, the education system, the kids at home being homeschooled, kids, you know, Black and brown kids that lived in poor neighborhoods, were not getting the same education that the kids in the suburbs are getting, you know, even
access to Wi-Fi,
right,
you know, all of those electronic tools that,
right,
that the rest of us take for granted.
Yes.
Yeah. I forgot what I was going to say. You said something and I forgot, and I had a really good point too, and it just went away.
Yeah.
Oh, no, I remember. At the beginning of you know, towards the beginning of the pandemic. So I went March, it was 2 days, no, wait a minute. It was about 5 days before we went online, before Edinburgh went online. My spouse and I were sitting there and I was saying, do I think I need to go get her? Maybe I need to wait until the weekend. And then something happened. There was a press conference or something, you know, right after we had this conversation, well, I'll wait till the weekend, you know, and then I'll drive down and go get her. And then after that press conference, he looked at me and he said, you need to go tomorrow. And I said, you're right. You know, so I hopped in the car on Thursday, got there on Friday. We started packing up her residence hall room, you know, got it all packed up and in storage. And then we're back on the road on Saturday. 12 hours we did all that and then got back on the road. So maybe 2 weeks after that, we needed groceries. So we ordered from, you know, a local grocery store. And so I went to pick it up. And so I'm the person in the house who doesn't have any comorbidities. So I went to pick it up. And so, you know, I backed the car in and I raised the hatch and stuff. And the woman comes out and she puts the groceries and everything in the back. And so I said, I'd like to give you a tip. And just so y'all know, see, this is rubbing alcohol. This is 91% 91 proof rubbing alcohol. I take it everywhere I go.
She does.
I do. I spray the money, you know, before I hand it to you, and then I'll toss it back. I'm not throwing money at you. I'm not, you know, it's not the strip club. But she said, well, we're not allowed to take tips.
Right.
And I said, what?
Right.
Yep. And the workplace had prohibited them from taking tips. And I was livid. I mean, I was really upset, you know, because I never thought about packing groceries as dangerous work before.
Right.
And there it was.
I'm gonna say I had a similar experience last school year. I had 6 kids at home from elementary school up to seniors in high school. So I had all these kids, and I remember they were sending them home. Well, we thank God have enough computers. Mm-hmm. We had enough iPads. We had enough technology.
We had Wi-Fi.
Mm-hmm. And I remember I thought to myself, well, this is gonna last about 2-3 weeks. I better go get some groceries. Some toilet paper. And I remember I went to a big box place, and we were in the line. Me and one of my older daughters, we were in the line, and I bought probably a month's worth of food for a family of 8. It was a lot of food, you know. And she goes, "Wow, this is a lot," you know. And I say, "Yeah." And
oh, yeah, yeah.
But yeah, I said, yeah, you know, we were getting, and as we were talking, she was telling me how she didn't know, you know, she wasn't allowed any time off. She had a 6 or 7 year old at home. They didn't have a computer. The school district wasn't giving them a computer, that they had been doing work on her phone. I said, and I was like, do you want to, you know, I'm not allowed to take a tip. And I was in the store shopping, you know, but I just thought, you know, here this woman is risking her. And she said, I can't afford to, like, leave my job, you know. And I said, I just could not believe that she was being forced to work and try to figure out childcare, the childcare center.
Right.
I mean, you know, it just really showed the disparity of how this really affected, you know, people.
Well, and then also the cultural component of this too. So, telling you the truth, I'm not lying. I used to lecture about this very scenario. When I was teaching sociology, you know, I would lecture about, when I would talk about class, socioeconomic class, and when I would talk about social determinants, you know, those social characteristics that determine, you know, all kinds of outcomes in your life. And so one of the things I talked about was cashiers, you know, and grocery stores. And because inevitably, you know, someone in class would, you know, make a statement about, well, you know, you should, if you want a better job, you should just, you know, go to do what I did, go to school, you know, pull yourself up by your bootstraps, those kinds of arguments. And so I would inevitably make give this example or ask this question. Do you really want the person who is checking you out, you know, having to come into work sick because they can't afford to take a day off, because they either don't have sick time, or because when they take the day off, they don't get paid for it. If they don't get paid, their kid eats. So they come to work coughing all over your pork chops when they check you out. Do you really want that? Because that's the system that we currently have. And then when I went that day to pick up those groceries, that lecture came to mind. Well, here it is in full force. COVID has laid bare all of the inequities that have been hidden from most people in our society, right? It's just, it's amazing. And it's changed our behavior. Like, I don't know that I'll ever shake somebody's hand ever again. I don't know. We were in, we took our daughter back to school because they're online, but she's there. They just decided to go online, which thank God, right? But again, if we needed something that we didn't have, I was the person to go out and get it. So I went to Home Depot and I was in line, and this older woman and her daughter were in line behind me, and I had picked up some hand sanitizer, and so I'm rearranging things in my car, trying to get ready to check out, and I feel a hand on my shoulder, and the look on my—that's how I look. I look like this, y'all, right? And so, I was looking at her, and I turned and I looked at her, and she recoiled because I didn't curse, but I was like, "Oh, Harry, you got your hands on me," mm-hmm. right? And so. But I wasn't mean about it, but I really was alarmed. I was deeply, deeply alarmed. And so she didn't understand why I was looking like that. And her daughter said to her, "Mom, you touched her. She's concerned about it." And she's like, "Oh my goodness." You know, all she wanted to tell me was that the hand sanitizer I had in my cart had been recalled. That's all she wanted to tell me. But it, you know, that's not a thing I would have.
Right.
I wouldn't have had that reaction 6 months ago, to somebody being nice to me and telling me this product that you have is probably unsafe.
As I said, I had a grandson over the summer during COVID, and Monday, we go to the farmer's market every Monday. So I had him in the stroller, and he is bulletproof in that stroller.
He has the covering. We keep the
top. He's like a boy in the bubble.
He's not been seen, so people probably think he's imaginary. So this lady comes up to me, this older lady, she comes up to me and she puts her face right by the stroller, but she couldn't see through his bulletproof, stuff. And she goes, "Oh, can I see your baby?" And my first reaction was, I said, "Hell no." This is like an older lady, and she doesn't. My husband goes, "Well, she don't know better." He goes, "No." I said, "Man, we're in the pandemic. You know, we can't be, breathing a little baby." But she acted kind of a little bit like
she felt offended.
Yeah,
which I don't get. I don't get it either. But we're gonna have before COVID. We're always gonna have before. before, it's just like 9/11, mm-hmm. right? Before 9/11, after 9/11, like before 9/11, you could go to the airport without having to strip, right? After 9/11, you got to strip. And I think the same thing is going to happen before and after COVID, because, you know, we're just beginning to get, scientists are just beginning to get a handle on what this awful, awful, awful disease is, right? Just now, they're beginning to get their arms around it. You know, we don't know that we'll ever get a vaccine. You know, really the way to change the trajectory of this is to change behavior. And so this is going to be with us for a long time. It's going to be with us for a long time. And I think our behaviors are going to change, including things like the way we teach, mm-hmm. right? The way people learn. I mean, what do you think the effects of this are going to be on kids?
I really do think about that, because we spend so much time. So I have another grandson that's 7. We spend so much time telling them to share, and you know, they hug each other.
Yeah.
And they, he's a boy, yeah, you
don't
know.
Know.
Right. Yeah. And now it's like, don't touch him, don't go near him, don't, you know. And I think that we already see the effects of like our generation from the younger generation. When I think back to like the generation that's right now in college, none of them have linked a postage stamp. Mm-hmm. They've always had Google, you know, where we were looking up stuff in encyclopedias. So for them,
never heard of ringtone.
My grandson one time had a really hard time looking at a rotary. He didn't know what it was because he's so used to a cell phone. But right, so you know, I think now these kids already are so much screen time, and so much stuff is already over. Like my son can spend hours playing the game, and I'm like, "What are you doing?" Well, I'm talking to, and for him, that's socializing, talking to his friends over this, you know, microphone. But I think we're going to see a lot of people, I think we've already started seeing a lot more anxiety, depression.
I agree.
Mental health issues, you know. I don't know what the effects will be 20 years from now, but like, we keep going in this no touch. Because humans need touch.
Right.
Humans need touch.
Right. For development.
Yeah.
Literally for development. Yeah, I think about the kids a lot, but I also think about, you know, that you know, adults are out here trying to deal with the stress of this,
mm-hmm.
and you know, most of us don't have good coping strategies either.
Right.
You know, one of the things I continually think about is, you know, that people are locked in with their family members now. Even if you like your family members, that's a bit much, right? Even, you know, on a regular day, you don't see your family members 24/7,
right?
Nobody's house is big enough to get away from, you know, there. So even in a good situation, people, you know, you love your family members, you like them, you know, you get along well, but everybody needs some kind of time alone just to think, to be in your own head. But I thought a lot about people who were in bad and or abusive relationships. What do you do? And then think about what it meant to be in that kind of relationship, but then to have all those other social factors that we talked about that COVID has laid bare on top of that. So you're in an abusive relationship, you're poor, you're isolated from your family. Maybe you don't have a job. If you do have a job, maybe it doesn't. What if it doesn't pay that much money? You know, you don't want to leave your home because you don't want to go to your mom's house and potentially give her COVID. Or, you know, I mean, the list of factors in this, you know, makes what is already an awful situation that much worse. And we know that the rates of interpersonal violence went up during it, or have gone up.
And child abuse have gone up,
you know, during this time. And we're going to have to deal with the effects of that for decades to come,
right?
Yeah. Yeah, that was not happy. All right. Mm-hmm. We have about 18 minutes left. What else do we want to talk about?
There was one question that I was thinking as you were talking. I know you talked a lot about where we were and what happened this summer. What are some, you made some great points about technology, people being at home with their family and having some opportunities to talk. And also we have technology that's able to catch some of these instances with the police on camera. So going towards the future, how do you see technology and how do you see COVID-19 and all the current circumstances? What are the implications for the future? Do you see these tools as a way to kind of bridge the understanding of racial diversity and race relations? Or do you see as it kind of a way to be a little more divisive as people are becoming more argumentative and more, you know, defensive about their viewpoint?
Facebook thugging.
Yeah.
People get behind social media and make crazy comments
that they would never
say in somebody's face. Yeah.
Uh-huh. And they got their degree from Facebook University. Is
yes. Right. Yes. Or Twitter U.
Yeah. So basically, if you can just talk about the future summer.
What'd you say, Chris?
So basically, just the future implications from what have happened over the summer. I think that'd be a nice way to kind of wrap everything up.
Okay.
How do I see technology changing race relations?
And also, not necessarily just technology, but technology in addition to what happened this summer. You can take COVID, you can take our awareness over what's happening, you can take technology. Where we are right now after reflecting on this summer, how do you see this playing out in the future?
You know how much I love technology. You do. I absolutely think that technology can be, I think it can be a vehicle and an effective vehicle for social change. I'm hedging that. I shouldn't hedge it. I think it's an effective vehicle for social change. I just do. Because there's even a theory of kind of the evolution of societies that is predicated on technology, that with every new major development in technology, societies change, right? They evolve into a quote-unquote higher state of a society. So I actually think that technology can be used for good. And in this instance, I really think that technology has been a positive force after this summer. So one of the things that happened early on is that people just started doing webinars and talks. Mm-hmm. I learned so much stuff.
Yep. all the free information that was given out during those times. Mm-hmm. I felt closer to people like I don't want to say like celebrities or like mm-hmm. political figures, like people, like you were in people's living rooms with them while they were, talking to us. And like you said, there was just so much information out there that if you didn't grab some of it, I mean.
Right.
Like,
now, though, here's the thing, is that we had access to that.
Correct.
Right. So when we talk about our experiences, we are not talking about the vast majority of people in this country. We're talking about our middle class existence, right? There are students that we teach
yes.
who don't have computers
yes.
or Wi-Fi in their homes,
yes.
right? And that is a much more widespread fact of social life in the United States than most of us who sit in solidly middle class existence don't ever see. We don't ever see that. So on the one hand, I think that technology is a good thing and that it can actually help to create knowledge and it can help to disseminate knowledge more freely. in order for it to disseminate knowledge freely, it has to be available to everybody, and it's not now. And so that's my only kind of hesitation about it, is that if people can't get access to it, then, you know, well, how much can it really change things?
So I think that we are definitely moving to a society where businesses found out that it was more productive and cost efficient to have all the workers at home. You know, schools, I mean, while they are having some issues, are finding that that virtual learning isn't so bad. You know what I mean? You can do a lot with technology. So I think that like you said, there's good and bad with the technology side.
It's always a double-edged sword.
But I think it's gonna, I think people, as technology progresses, we become a more and more isolated,
I agree,
society where we are not getting out more. We are not, we'll just Zoom call grandma instead of going over our house on Sunday. Like, you know. Save on gas, I won't have to get in my car.
Right.
You know, so.
Right. Yeah, you're right. I think it's a double-edged sword.
Yeah, definitely.
But one of the things, but this summer, I've seen it really used positively.
Yes.
I have. I think it's an effective tool, you know, in the fight for social change.
Right.
Yeah. So what are some of the things that you would tell people about, you know, how they can kind of take care of themselves through this process? What kinds of things can people do?
I mean, I'm probably gonna say like some cliche things, but again, exercise. I tried to take up yoga during COVID. Yeah, you laugh. That's a lot of the time in the fetal position. You know, just chanting to myself. I think it's really important to know your limits. Social media can be really great, because we've seen some really great things like D Nice's Quarantine Club.
Oh, man.
Including Michelle Obama's gym today.
Oh.
Or the Verse.
Yes.
I mean, so like you can see where social media has brought bright spots in this whole thing, but at the same time, like, again, you need to limit your social media so you're not watching these same videos over and over and over and over again. I think we all got into a slump of eating bad, you know. You get to eating bad.
Let me tell you something. Whoever made those Oreo thin lattes, they're from the devil. That stuff is delicious.
I also think taking time for yourself, like even there was many a night when I sat out on my back porch all by myself, or sit in my car in the driveway. The kids would be like, "What you out there doing?" Being by myself. At one point, I even had a candle I put on the dashboard.
just sit.
I just need a moment, guys, just to be by myself. Seriously, but I just think that really all the same things that we all, you know. Good diet, exercise. I know a lot of people, we got a home gym, you know, we started, you know, doing the home gym thing. So my son likes to work out, so he can work out, you know, just walking around the block, you know, things like that. But I think limiting your social media and screen time was super important this summer.
You know, one of the things I did was, I started volunteering, even if it was just online.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it was just online. But I started volunteering with organizations that I thought were worth my time to
mm-hmm.
volunteer for. I gave money to causes.
I did too, yes.
You know, and so, you know, in a time when you're locked in,
mm-hmm.
you know, especially if you're a person like who likes to be out and who likes to go and like physically go and do things. It was really important to me to feel like I was actually doing something.
Right.
And so I shifted the way I thought about contributing to other things. You know, if people ask me to speak to their group on a particular subject, you know, I do it. Or so that really helped me. It made me feel like I still had a sense of purpose. It gave me a sense of purpose. And then one of the other things I continue to do is I just kind of get into the things I really like. Mm-hmm. And I don't really care whether, you know, what that looks like to other people, but I never have. I made a change in that. But I used to be able to read. Like, I used to be able to sit down with a book, read a novel, and just kind of, and I can't do that anymore. Right. I can't do it. But so what I did instead was I went to LeVar Burton's podcast, LeVar mm-hmm. Burton Reads. Oh, 30 short stories, you know, somewhere between 30 and 45 minutes, and then he talks a little bit about it afterwards, just brings me, you know, it's de-stresses, just kind of brings me all the way.
And I was going to say, I started doing Audible in the beginning of the pandemic, like sometimes I just put it on and like clean and like oh. whatever, or walk around. And I've never been my mother listens to books, so I always thought of it as an old people thing. You can do it. Old people listen to books on tape. But, like, yeah, I really started enjoying myself reading, like, listening to people read, like, Michelle Obama.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, in her voice. And, like, oh, okay.
Yeah. I also want to recommend, if I could make one recommendation, if you could download the app called Libby, it's Libby, you can actually connect
to
your library and download audiobooks from the library for free. I've downloaded everything from President Obama's memoir to I'm listening to a book now called Bear Town. There's new releases, memoirs, mm-hmm. kids books, all connected to your library card.
Right. So, because the Erie Public Library, you can access the Erie Public Library, I think, through Libby.
Yep.
But also, I think the Erie Public Library has its own. Too.
If you have your your library card number, all you do is you enter that in the Libby. It connects you to the Erie County Library. A lot of the popular new releases, you might have a line for, but you can place a hold and it'll let you know as soon as it becomes available. But yeah, I listen to a lot of books. I listened to Alexander Hamilton's book that the musical.
Oh, the
Ron
Chernow book.
Yeah, right. I listened to that through that Libby app, so that was kind of a cool. I mean, it took me probably a year worth of drives to and from work to finish it, but it was definitely worth it. We did have one more question. I think would be a nice wrap up for this evening. I know we're running low on time, but in regards to the Black Lives Matter movement, what are some ways that other groups such as white women, Latinx, Chinese American, all sorts of groups, how can they be supportive allies without doing more damage? And also certain groups, if you're in a majority group, to kind of be aware of your privilege, but still be able to contribute to the cause. I've seen some people post a lot of support for Black Lives Matter through Facebook and Twitter and Instagram, but sometimes it can be an intrusion or kind of overstepping their bounds. In your opinion and in your experience, what are some ways that people from different ethnic backgrounds, different racial backgrounds contribute?
Let's see, first thing off my mind, I'll donate money.
That was the first thing I thought.
Sure.
Donate.
So people can continue to do the work. I think that my first answer is my first answer to almost anything, which is to educate yourself, right? We just got through talking about ways you can access information, and there are a lot of good, really good people out here who have been doing this work for years. There are lots of really good anti-racist educators out there. Tim Wise is one that comes to mind. Robin DiAngelo is one that comes to mind. Robin DiAngelo's book is called White Fragility, and I think you guys are probably, you probably have heard about that. But, you know, not expecting people to educate you on stuff that you can easily find out for yourself. you know, being aware that what we are all talking about now is trauma. It's trauma experienced, and it's trauma induced. The witnessing of it is trauma inducing. Let me also say this. I think that when we talk about trauma, we often talk about, you know, the trauma that we experience as Black people or as Latinx people or Indigenous people or LGBTQ. We talk about trauma. And especially now, we're talking about it more, I think, than we ever have. But one of the things that I recognize is that in this moment, this summer, large numbers of white people actually were traumatized too, right? Now, this is not to excuse people's behavior, but when we see people start to awaken because they've gotten knowledge that they didn't have before, especially knowledge that's traumatic, you know, it's tough to deal with. And so one of the things that I would say to white allies, the second thing, besides educate yourself, the second thing I would say to white allies is counseling. And I'm not even joking about that, right? Because this work is hard. Think about the fact that you've been walking through your life clueless, you know, some of y'all for many decades, right? You've been walking it through your life clueless about these things that have happened. And now, this summer, you see them in living color, right? And you want to do something, and you feel bad, but you just don't know what to do. But you know you don't want to go back to where you were. You need therapy. You need therapy. You need to be able to talk to somebody about it, because getting to a point where you can actually be out here making change, right? The change that we need is tough emotional work. And one of the parts of the movement that I've seen that I really like is that there are some really good anti-racist organizations out there that are solely educating white people. It is white people who have done the work out here educating other white people who want to do work. And I think that's really important. But it's important to be an ally in those kinds of ways, right? Showing up, you know, giving money and all of that. But you also have to do the internal work.
Being aware of your privilege.
Yeah.
And when we say white privilege, it's not, I think
that's our hour.
Okay. Exactly. I think some people get really offended, like it's some sort of bad thing, but it's just a privilege you were born with. And you know.
And that the system was designed for
right.
it to happen.
Right. Yeah. And now that you are aware of it, you know, you can definitely make changes to society. So again, all lives, you know, Black
we can
lives
get
matter,
to a
so.
Point, yeah, that Black Lives Matter, Indigenous Lives Matter, that, you know, on and on and on, that people are that people are given every benefit that's written in those ideal words in the founding documents.
I think that is just about the best ending point we could have. I think I wanted to thank Dr. Matthews and Professor Berry for your time. I think we learned a lot. It was almost difficult because I'm trying to host and moderate, but I also want to take notes too, because these are situations that it seems almost cyclical, that it happens, like each generation has their moment where racial tensions hit a fever pitch, and it's just a matter of time before we figure everything out. And I think that what you've talked about today, great starting points. Also, what I'd like to do to follow up is I will work with Dr. Terrence Mitchell and the both of you to come up with a resource list that we could put together for people that have a conversation. So we can talk about, since you're, we could talk about movies, documentaries, reading material as kind of a follow-up to this, so that not only can we provide these viewpoints today, but we can provide further research and further studies as well. So On behalf of Edinburgh University, thank you everybody for joining us, and thank you Dr. Matthews and Professor Barry for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.